The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management or staff of Radio Kingston, WKNY. AM 1490, FM 1079, Kingston, New York.
Give myself to you completely.
Good morning. It is 10 a.m. on Saturday, and you're listening to Radio Kingston. And that means that it is time for your weekly dose of Nature Nuggets. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland. And the purpose of this program is to take a minute, an hour, actually, in this case, and explore and celebrate the natural world. We live in such tumultuous times where the daily news cycle can be a major anxiety inducer every morning waking up to see what has just happened in the last 24 hours. And I firmly believe that, you know, one of the biggest things we can rely on for our mental health and for our physical health and for our well-being is connecting to the natural world. And we're very fortunate here in the Hudson Valley to be surrounded by so much biodiversity, diverse ecosystems, and incredible species. And so the idea of this show is to bring on a new guest every week to help be a guide and to share their expertise and their insights about the more than human world. And so we seek out scientists and educators and artists and activists and people of all sorts who come on the show. And today I am very excited to have Omari Washington live and in person in the studio. Thanks, Omari.
Thank you, Laurel.
And, you know, I think we all can, you know, relate to the need, especially right now, for, you know, time in nature. There is something eternal and in our bone marrow about the experience of being outside that just helps make sense out of the chaos of the rest of the human world. And so whether you're, you know, right here in your backyard or even on Broadway in Midtown Kingston, or whether you're on the shoreline of the tidal estuary of the Hudson River or out deep on the mountaintop in the Catskills, there is always an incredible symphony of complicated living creatures that are living out their lives and doing all the interesting, crazy things that they do. And so what we do here is, you know, try to explore some of those things. And some of them are exotic and rare, but even the most common, easily overlooked elements of our natural world are worth slowing down for a minute and tuning into. So we're going to do a little bit of that. And the idea really being that I feel strongly that people won't fight for what they don't love, and they can't love what they don't know. So with that, I'm going to start our program with a section called Who's About Town, which we do every week. And Who's About Town is a bit like the Society Pages, but instead of celebrities, we're talking about the more than human world that we share our time and space with. I just this morning walked over to the studio a few minutes ago from my house in Midtown Kingston. First thing I heard when I stepped out onto my front porch was a Carolina wren, which is a bird that actually does stay through the winter, but they're just so delightful, a little brown wren. And they even will sing through the winter. But this one, they make a lot of different kinds of sounds. And this one this morning wasn't singing. She was just sort of doing this little churry, churry chirp thing that she does. But it just immediately kind of shocked me into awareness, you know, that there she is living her life. And it would be so easy to overlook her. But she's announcing her presence, you know, voluminously. And if we just slow down a little bit and look a little bit closer, she is the kind of experience that, you know, is always at our hands. And I had another one of those earlier this week. This week has been very exciting. From the perspective of a naturalist and a birder, spring is on. We're still a week from the vernal equinox, but it's undeniable. If you've been outside in the last week, you certainly have seen some signs that are impossible to ignore. And one of them, just this past week between last episode and this one, in the early morning, opened my window in my bedroom and heard a sound that I hadn't heard for many, 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 many months. And I won't be able to do it justice, but it's like a bzz, 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 bzz. And that is the song of the Eastern Phoebe. And that means that she's back. And it was probably a he, actually, because with birds, generally, and everybody has exceptions, but generally the males are the ones who sing. And they do it in spring, right? And they are telling other males, hey, back off. This is my territory. I'm, if you can hear me, that means that you're getting too close. This is my space. And to females, it means, hey, I'm strong. I'm able to provide for you. Check me out. I've got a nest that I can build for you. And Eastern Phoebes are, a drab little bird in many ways. They're a flycatcher, so they specialize in sitting on a perch and then doing little sallies out. They call it a sally, out, to catch a bug, and then they land back where they were. And they're kind of a gray-green little flycatcher, but they really have a winning personality. And what they lack in, extravagant plumage, they make up for with their sweet personality. And so they have just arrived. And the reason that they are here so much earlier than other birds is because they are a short distant migrant. So a lot of our songbirds are coming in the coming months, all the way from Central America, even South America. But the Eastern Phoebe tends to just go down to the Appalachians, maybe Florida, but which allows them to arrive earlier in the spring. And they, it also makes me think of the fact that, obviously not all birds migrate, right? So we have blue jays, we have cardinals, we have juncos, we have many species who have been here all winter, titmice, chickadees. And there's a certain advantage to that. So, they've suffered through the winter, they've made it work, and that allows them to get a head start on spring. So when it comes to building up your fat reserves and, getting your breeding on, making eggs, building a nest, they can get started, right now in March. Whereas, if you imagine the energy it takes for a migratory bird to travel thousands and thousands of miles, transform its plumage, and then land, ready to make babies. It's a huge expenditure of energy. And so we're at this neat moment in the season right now where you can really see the resident birds taking advantage of the fact that they didn't have to do all of that, and they can get started a bit earlier. Eastern Phoebe, absolute harbinger of spring. They come weeks and weeks before most of the big flashy sort of rainforest birds. But of course, we're seeing lots of other birds, right? The red-winged blackbirds are back. Robins are here. We're seeing raptors starting to arrive. And I had another really cool experience this last week, which I'm hoping some people that are listening may have seen as well, which is I went down to Slatesburg Spit, which, if you're not familiar, if you're in Kingston, you just go over that 9W bridge. It's your first left in Port Ewan. And you can go down, and there's a preserve with a beautiful trail that takes you out onto a long, narrow spit that is, goes deep into, it's the mouth of the Rondout Creek, and it goes into the Hudson River. And, it's complicated, like so much of our world. There's a lot of invasive and non-native species that are occupying that patch of land. But there's also a huge amount of biodiversity. And I was out there, 3 or 4 days ago, sort of end of the day, and I'm very much appreciating the extra hour we have after the working day to get outside now. And anyway, it was the lowest tide I have ever seen in the Hudson River. There was mud for hundreds of yards out. And so at Slatesburg Spit, you can walk all the way out to the end of the point there, and you have a beautiful view of this old rusty crane that's been abandoned for decades. And on top of that crane is a osprey nest, which hasn't been started to being rebuilt yet, but fingers crossed, hopefully, they will be arriving soon and getting to work fixing up that battered nest from last year. But there's an island that is on the other side of a sort of a creek, and I've been there dozens and dozens of times over the years, and I had never seen a tide so low where I realized I was actually able to rock hop across the gully and go over to this, what usually is an island. And there were cardinals singing, but one of the things I noticed was a lot of bivalves. So, you know, mussels, clams, because the tide was exposed, a lot of these shells were exposed that you wouldn't normally see. And I saw zebra mussels, which, of course, are a highly invasive species, unfortunately. I also saw Asian clams, another not native species. But I also saw many, many native freshwater mussels. And if you go down to the shore, especially at a low tide on the Hudson, you might see these. And I used my trusty app called Seek, which is related to iNaturalist. And it's kind of a magical little device that's free to download on your phone. And you can point Seek at just about anything, from a plant to a freshwater mussel. And it will often tell you right off the bat what you're looking at. And so it's a bit of a pro tip hack for modern naturalists. And the one of the animals I was looking at was called an Eastern Elliptio, which is a very cool name for a native mussel. And these are found all across the eastern seaboard, all the way up to Hudson Bay, and certainly throughout the Hudson here where we live. And, you know, it's easy to look at this kind of mud-colored little bivalve and not think too much of it. But when you actually look into their life history, they are bizarre. The life history, the life cycle of these freshwater mussels, because they're animals, right? They're alive, but they can't move about on their own accord. So the way that they have figured out to reproduce is that they use fish. And each freshwater mussel often has a relationship with different fish species. And some of them are so adapted that they actually stick out a little lure that looks like a small fish, and they stick it out of their shell, and they wiggle it around. And it's a temptation for a specific species of fish that they're looking for. And when that fish comes close to them, they eject their little babies, which attach themselves to the gills of the fish. And then it's a necessary part of their life cycle is to be captured by the fish, moved around. And then when they grow to a certain extent, they'll drop off of the fish and they don't kill it, but they, you know, I think they are considered a parasite. And then they grow into a new mussel and grow a shell. And so it's just an incredible, you know, case of, well, I don't know if it's symbiosis, it might be parasitism, because I don't know if the fish gets anything out of the deal. But it's very interesting. And as I was looking at the tide, it was so low. I actually Googled it and looked up, like, you know, is there some kind of, you know, king tide happening here? What's going on with the moon? And I couldn't find news about it. But then yesterday, I got my favorite email of the week, which I talk about most weeks on this program, which is the Hudson River Almanac from the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Tom Lake is their naturalist. And he let me know that, in fact, a lot of people who have been in the area for a long time were saying that this was the lowest tide they'd ever seen. And it has a term. It's called a blowout tide. And so it's not just a product of the sun and the moon and the general tidal forces that we think of that create most tides. A blowout tide is a relatively rare phenomenon. that occurs when you have strong and persistent winds blowing in a very particular direction, in this case, north-northwest winds. And that actually literally, because we had, if you remember this last week, you know, really sustained winds, 40, 50 miles an hour, going in same direction for hours and hours. And that literally, physically pushed the river out and exposed huge mudflats. And so I saw a lot of treasure hunters out there. I ran into a guy who had a metal detector and, you know, other people who recognized this rare phenomenon as a opportunity to go find, you know, cool things that are usually hidden by the water. So that was very cool. Yeah, there's so many signs of spring going on. And one of them that I want to highlight right now, very cool, very seasonally specific phenomenon, is the skunk cabbage. And if you don't know skunk cabbage, you may actually have seen it, but it's it has huge leaves. It grows in deep forest, usually in like a sort of a swampy or riverside area. But skunk cabbage has a very unique and particular way of, you know, being able to emerge in the spring, because most flowers and plants have to wait until the danger of a hard frost has passed. But skunk cabbage has figured out that they can get a head start. And so the sort of plum-colored, kind of mottled leaves of skunk cabbage will start to push up, even if there's heavy snow on the ground in, you know, early March around our area. And they have the unique and crazy ability to do something called thermogenesis. And so what that means is that the skunk cabbage is able to use oxygen to produce heat. So they store a bunch of starch in their root systems, and then in the spring, early spring, even kind of late winter, they pull in a tremendous amount of oxygen, more oxygen than any other plant is known to do, and they pull that starch from their roots, and they combine it with the oxygen, and they break molecular bonds apart to release energy that creates heat. Which is just astounding. And so, you know, it's thought that they've measured it, you know, that some skunk cabbage, you know, early plants can be like 70 degrees, even when, so they'll actually melt the snow that's around them. And the colder it is, the more oxygen they will pull in. And they're just an incredible plant. You can see them, if you go to the same spot really day by day this time of year, you can actually see them grow. It'll be, the same plant will be larger than the day before that you saw it, because they have a huge underground root structure that they, all summer long when it's hot and wet, they pump energy into their roots so they can get ready for the following season. They also, they're called skunk cabbage because they have a rank odor that has been described as a combination of rotting meat, apples, turnips, and garlic, which is a kind of a, you know, gross perfume, but that's designed to attract attention. And if you're an early bug, if you're a honeybee or a fly, there's not much going on yet in the woods in March, but so they will flock to it. Both because they can smell it and they want to feed from it, but also because of the heat, they can find warmth through the night. And so you'll see a lot of insects actually gathering around and just, you know, taking kind of warmth and comfort from the skunk cabbage. So check that out. It's happening all around, even on the linear park trail here in Kingston. If you're walking, you know, right across from the studio here, there's a little swampy area that is full of emerging skunk cabbage right now. All right, well, I'm gonna do at least one more who's about town, and this one is about a common bird that you are almost certainly familiar with, even if you don't know, and that's a white-throated sparrow. And White-throated sparrows are a cheerful, bright little bird. They've got black and white stripes on the top of their head and a bright, crisp white throat, which they're named for. And this is a bird that occupies quite a bit of North America. In the winter, they are all over the southern part of the country. And then in the breeding season coming up, they will be all over Canada and breeding far to the north. But there's a narrow band, and they usually represent this as purple if you look at a bird distribution map, where they are year-round residents. And we happen to live here in New York in that narrow band where white-throated sparrows might be coming from the south, and this is where their northern destination is, where they're going to breed, or they might be from the north, and this is where they're wintering. But this is just a kind of an incredible thing. And, you know, I love following out in the valley on the air because, and I think this is a great example, looking at this bird, of how we can make so many assumptions about what we think we know about gender and sexuality. And when we look into the natural world, we see this incredibly chaotic, really confusing diversity. And, Audubon himself, John James Audubon, when he first painted white-throated sparrows in the 1800s, he painted the bright-colored one and labeled it the male, and then he painted the drab brown one and labeled it the female. And that was, you know, based on a lot of knowledge of the way that birds work, is that the bright, fancy one is the male and the dull one is the female. It turns out he was wrong. And it took people centuries really of looking at white-throated sparrows before anybody quite noticed that there's a lot more going on there than we had understood. And so on closer inspection, white-throated sparrows are quite remarkable. And if you assume that the brighter bird in each breeding pair is the male, you would be right about half the time. And so that's because in about 50% of breeding pairs of white-throated sparrows, the brighter bird has the testes and the drabber bird has the ovaries, which is the normal pattern for a songbird. But the other 50%, the more striking plumage is the one with the ovaries and the duller one is the one with the testes. And this took a lot of bird nerds paying attention for a while to, you know, figure this out. And looking at the quote-unquote female is up there singing and the quote-unquote male is in the nest laying eggs. And so they've come to call this bird because they have two morphs. They have the white-striped morph and the tan-striped morph. And morph doesn't have anything to do with sex, but it does matter to the birds themselves. And so they will always choose one of the other morph. So if you're still following me, this means that each bird is choosing a mate from only 25% of the population. And so they call it, some people have called it, the bird with four sexes, which isn't quite true because they don't have four different types of gonads. But they do have this highly, version of sex variability, which is not at all apparent at first to the naked eye. So this is a bird you probably have in your backyard. And so next time you see one, take a look, and you may well see the plainer looking one singing a song and the fancier looking one building a nest. Okay, with that, I am going to pause for a moment, and we're going to hear some messages from our community.
Hi, I'm Devin, the Direct Service and Outreach Coordinator for the Kingston Emergency Food Collaborative, KEFC. We're looking for volunteers to help us with our direct service initiative that provides groceries to folks in our community who are struggling with food insecurity. You can volunteer to deliver or pack groceries. Grocery deliveries are the second and last Wednesday of each month. On the second and last Tuesday, there are packing shifts from 10 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. On the second and last Wednesday, there are packing shifts from 9:30 to 11 a.m., and delivery pickup is at 11:15 a.m. If you'd like to volunteer on an occasional or recurring basis, visit kingstonemergencyfood.com.
Idakoye Oyasi, Radio Kingston.
Many voices.
Many voices.
Many voices, one community. out. Chante washte na page use al pielo. Miecha, ein, tiokas and ghost tours. Join me for First Voices Radio Sunday nights at 7 p.m. here at Radio Kingston. We'll bring you indigenous perspectives from every continent on earth that includes your discussions, music, and interviews.
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth.
That's First Voices Radio, Sunday nights from 7 to 8, here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 107.9, or anytime at radiokingston.org. Midakuye oyasi.
Hudson Valley Large Scale Railroad Club is hosting the Kingston Model Train and Railroad Hobby Show at the Andy Murphy Neighborhood Center Sunday, March 23rd. There will be operating layouts, a large-scale garden railroad train display, model train exhibits, Lego trains, Thomas the Tank engine trains, and a kids' corner play area. There will also be a dealer and vendor tables as well as train raffles. Admission is $8 for adults and $2 for children under 12. Kingston Model Train and Railroad Hobby Show, Sunday, March 23rd, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Andy Murphy Neighborhood Center, 467 Broadway in Kingston. For tickets and more information, kingstontrainshow.com. Welcome back. You are listening to Nature Nuggets, and I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and I am delighted to be joined in the studio today by Omari Washington, who's the executive director of Wild Earth. And Omari, I just talked a bunch in the first 20 minutes of our show about some of my experiences at the emergence of spring. And before I formally introduce you and we get into your work, I'm just curious if you know what have been some of the things that you've noticed in this season so far.
Yeah, I had a great opportunity to walk down at Kingston Point this week, and just being down on the waterfront, saw a plethora of birds, and you've named a few, the red-winged blackbird. There was a tree full of them, and as we were walking by, they all scattered, and it's just beautiful to see. I also, saw an eagle flying there amongst a number of gulls and other birds that I couldn't identify. But, the eagle is, really special, I think, for New York State, as it's been a bird that has been, near endangered in our state. And after many years of work to protect their habitat and support their resurgence, we see them all the time now, and we see them behind our office in High Falls, and yeah, it's just a beautiful thing to have that proliferation of eagles in our community.
It is so cool. It's one of those things, just like anything else, that you can take for granted when you're used to it. But I love having family come visit or friends, and we'll go down to the waterfront and just all casually, oh, there's an eagle. And people are like, oh my God, there's a bald eagle. And I'm like, oh, right, that's cool. Because they are just absolutely majestic. And pretty much, any given day, if you go down to Kingston Point, like you're saying, you're likely to see one or more.
Yeah.
Yeah, very cool. And they're starting to nest right now. There's actually some cool nest cams down in Poughkeepsie where you can look that up and see, their daily antics gestating their eggs. All right, well, I'm going to, at the risk of embarrassing him a little, I'm going to pull from Omari's bio on his site at Wild Earth to give a little introduction. So I already said Omari Washington is the executive director of Wild Earth. And Omari Washington identified his purpose in 2004 during a backpacking and paddling trip above the Arctic Circle in Alaska. And despite emerging evidence, at that time, few people were willing to believe climatologists' warnings that humans were negatively impacting our planet. But hiking across the melting permafrost, Omari witnessed the huge changes taking place. And more than that, He knew that many marginalized communities would be disproportionately affected by inaction. After returning from that trip, Omari attended the Green Mountain College in Vermont and received a BA in Environmental Studies. And since then, he's led hikes in urban parks, managed diverse teams of environmental educators, built school gardens, developed curricula, and helped plant 1 million trees in New York City. And the focus of all this work has been to engage and empower youth in developing deep connections to nature, centered around their own unique experiences. I'm so glad to have you on the air today, Omari. This is such important work. And I love to start, asking, about if you had any kind of, spark experience or formative, mm-hmm. That led you into, dedicating your life to being an environmental educator.
Yeah, I think it really started, I think, with my mother, and she's an educator. She's worked at the university level, has worked for foundations supporting early childhood initiatives. And so I think I get that sense of, wanting to educate others from her. And so my first job that I had in high school was working as a tutor, working with young kids. And I think that probably, started it for me. But in terms of the environmental education piece of it, my mother really provided a lot of opportunities for us to, my sister and I, to be in nature and, going to nature preserves to, cookouts and parks, to when I was young, she enrolled me in Boy Scouts because she really wanted me to have, some guidance and mentorship from adults. And it was through that I really, was exposed to a lot of different skills and crafts and went camping. And I think, beyond the Boy Scouts experience, I just, as a kid, would explore the woods behind my house. And having that free rein to kind of imagine what the environment was at, times in the past, me and my friends would find kind of remnants of what we thought were from old battles in the area, we'd find little stone bridges that had collapsed, and we found a cannon once that we were like, oh, this must be someone left this here back in the 1800s, and I'm not sure if that was actually the case or if we were just imagining that and letting our imagination run wild. But I think that sense of being able to expand my world through my imagination is what showed me that anything is possible in the world. And I think that that's really important for children. And, kids that are growing up today, I think, have a more difficult time kind of accessing that sense of exploration and using their imagination because there's so much media and they're spending a lot of time looking at screens, and I think it can rob children from that sense of just being out and developing their own sense of the world and who they are in the world.
I love that's your origin story, and I deeply relate to it. I feel like the opportunity to have been exposed to, outdoor education and mentors who just, imagination run wild is a huge part of how I ended up on my life path. And that's a perfect segue into, you're playing that forward in such a beautiful way, because this is literally the work that you do. So I'd love to just take a minute and have you just introduce, to listeners who might not be familiar with Wild Earth, what is Wild Earth? What's the mission? What do you all do over there?
Absolutely. So Wild Earth has led nature-based programs since 2004. And, you know, we started by taking small groups of youth into the woods to play, explore, and learn earth living skills. Through that, we built out different programs. You know, we started with a summer camp, the origin of, before it was called Wild Earth, actually, it was called Red Fox Friends. Mm. So in 2004, Red Fox Friends came about because a group of parents in the community, like within Ulster County, who many of their children went to Waldorf schools and were used to them having a lot of time for exploration and play during the year, realized that during the summer they didn't have those opportunities and wanted to have some mentors, you know, really support them in their exploration and play. And so we started with a summer camp, and then it grew kind of word of mouth after the first year. Everyone was like, what's going on over here? This is an exciting opportunity for youth. And so kind of word of mouth, it grew. The organization added other programs, like our weekend programs at Ladle, Artemis, Ropes, which are really geared towards youth from ages 9 through high school, and to support them during important developmental periods in their life, stepping into adolescence, becoming a teenager and preparing for what they're going to do in the world. Through these experiences with Wild Earth, many participants and children, or I'm sorry, and families, parents and guardians say that, you know, their children are changed. And, for a long time, it was hard to kind of really pinpoint, why the children were being changed. And I think there are a lot of things that contribute to that. It's having the mentors, the instructors who really center the children's experiences. Our programs are really built around allowing children to have a lot of choice in what activities they want to participate in, how they want to show up in any given moment. We tend to have a lot of different activities that kind of speak to the different needs, whether it's, someone who needs to be running around a lot and, getting out a lot of energy, or there's activities where like a sit spot where we can just, sit and contemplate and, experience nature. And so I think having those different opportunities for kids to feel comfortable and supported really contributes to them feeling the sense of belonging and support. It's what we're doing is, seemingly very simple. We're going out into the woods, we're teaching them how to build fires and tend fires, and they're carving wood, and they're using natural dyes to create different things. They're making cordage and tracking and foraging. All of this is really supporting the children in finding their passion and what speaks to them. Over the last year or so, have really tried to distill what is the impact that we're having. And what we've identified as kind of an impact statement is that Wild Earth ignites transformative inner and communal connections through generational wisdom rooted in the natural world. And so all of these earth living skills and kind of ways of being really speak to a lot of practices that have been held by communities and cultures for many, many years, right? And so we see that in kind of looking back to what our ancestors may have created and centered within their worlds provides great guidance for us as we try to stay connected and rooted in nature.
It's so beautiful. It's such incredibly important work. It can seem so straightforward, but that, you know, nature deficit disorder has been, you know, identified as like an actual form of, you know, real anxiety and stress in, you know, in children. And so just bringing people, you know, kids outside and letting them, like you said, choose their own adventure, play in the mud, you know, and be around adults who, you know, point things out to them. So important. I've had the really cool experience, in addition to all the wonderful work that Omari is speaking to, Wild Earth also has a really strong merch game, and beautiful t-shirts, beautiful stickers, beautiful bags. They're, you know, just really beautiful local, you know, nature. In fact, I love one of your recent t-shirts was actually a possum, which I just love that you had a conversation around which animal to feature, and the possum made the cut because it's a very cool shirt. But I've had the experience wearing it around town, where more than once someone comes up to me and is like, oh my God, do you work for Wild Earth? And I have to say, no, I'm a poser, but I like the shirt. and inevitably that person's been like, oh, okay, well. But they had a transformative, now they're an adult, mm-hmm. you know, they're both times this has happened, this has been someone in their 20s, and they had this, you know, transformative life experience when they were younger, and when they saw that shirt, it just, they lit up, and clearly were, you know, it was something that they will never forget as long as they live. So it's been really sweet to see that just echo through time and community of the work that y'all do. Mm-hmm. Well, gosh, there's so much. You know, I know you have lots of programs. You've talked about the summer camps, mm-hmm. but I'd love to hear maybe if you could lay out just kind of briefly, you know, the variety of different kinds of programs that you offer.
Absolutely. Yeah, so we really started with those, what we call public programs, where, you know, folks can go to our website and they can sign up for a program. It's kind of a fee-for-service model, that we provide a lot of financial aid, and I can talk more about the structure of that later. But so we have these public programs that are based in the woods. We go out, we're outside all day. And then we, about 10 years ago, started working with first the Kingston City School District. We've worked with a few, actually, schools, but made a concerted effort to work with the Kingston City School District when they were looking to engage more community partners in the school. And we have been providing guided recess for elementary and middle school students. And what that looks like is, you know, during their recess time, you know, kids are going out to the blacktop in the middle schools, the playground, elementary schools, and they, you know, it's unstructured time, which, you know, we are, you know, support. We, kids need that. However, if it's too unstructured, it can be challenging, and, you know, can lead to behavioral issues and whatnot. And so the schools were seeing that after lunch, after recess, there were a lot more referrals, and, you know, principals were saying they were spending the rest of their day dealing with behavioral issues. And so when we came in to do guided recess, we saw a decline in those referrals because we were engaging the kids and, you know, running around, playing games. We have a nature table. We have books for kids to read. And so there are a lot of different ways they could enjoy that time. And so we have done guided recess and then also do after school programs, a field trip for mostly fifth, but some sixth grade classes as well at Juniper Flats, which is a scenic Hudson property in the town of Ulster. And getting kids out, you know, as fifth graders who have just arrived at middle school is a great opportunity for them to really come together as a class and, you know, work together, collaborate, have this, you know, transformative experience that really sets them up for a successful middle school career. And after these field trips that we do in the fall, we're at the school. And so they, you know, get to meet our staff during the field trips, and then they're, you know, seeing them there every week. And so we really get to build relationships with the youth for the whole rest of the school year. Yeah,
it's such it's such important work. And I wanted to follow up on, you know, I mean, one of the biggest issues, you know, unfortunately, it's become systemic, you know, is like accessibility to nature. And you know, there's such a huge gap. It's almost become the kind of thing where it's like, it's become like, a, you know, privilege, you know, to have access to nature. And of course, it's a basic human need and birthright. And one of the things I love is, you know, you, so you've mentioned bringing your work straight to the public schools and to recess. So that's a direct way to do it. But you kind of referenced, and I'd love to hear a little more about that sort of, you know, equity, you know, to nature, to access to nature, and how you navigate that and try to kind of pierce those those boundaries.
Absolutely. And, you know, equitable access to nature is interesting because in this community, because, you know, we are in a, you know, nature rich area where you have access to rivers that you can swim in and lakes and mountains. And so the physical access is oftentimes not the challenge. But there's a kind of psychological aspect of it that can keep people from going out, you know, whether it's they have developed a fear of nature or animals, bugs, they don't, or sometimes it's, you know, not having the right equipment, right? Not having the gear to be able to go out into nature and feel comfortable. But, you know, we have launched a initiative called Nature Everywhere because we don't want to assume that people don't spend time in nature because, you know, there are many ways to be outdoors, right? And we want to uplift, you know, whether it's kids spending time on their block, riding their bikes, you know, or, you know, having a cookout down, you know, at Kingston Point. So we're trying to, through this initiative, survey the community to understand how people are spending time in nature and what gaps there are for them if they're not spending time you know, recreating and exploring nature. Is that something they want to do, right? But what are the gaps if they, you know, perceive that there are some? And so through this initiative, we just launched it this year in collaboration with the City of Kingston, Cornell Cooperative Extension, the YMCA Farm Project, and the Kingston City School District. And so to really support the work that is happening so robustly in the schools, this is really to connect with the community more and to identify, you know, how do we support more engagement in our city parks, How do, you know, would people want to be spending more time in the Catskills or, you know, some of the preserves, you know, that are around, and how do we make those connections and uplift the things that are already happening, that different, you know, community organizations are supporting.
What an incredible resource for the community, for kids who are growing up here, and for parents. And it's very exciting to hear about that. And I love that broad-based collaboration you're just describing. We are going to take one more quick break to hear some words from our community, and then we're going to get back to our conversation with Omari Washington from Wild Earth.
What does community radio mean to you?
Folks can communicate with each other, different people from different backgrounds, different walks of life, share their opinions and not be judged about what they think and how they feel. This is an amazing opportunity for people to just be themselves collectively, and that's what truly makes community.
Radio Kingston.
Many voices, one community.
Hi, this is Lorraine from the Kingston Farmers Market. This winter, you can find us back inside the old Dutch church at 272 Wall Street every other Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Visit over 20 local vendors with fresh fruits and veggies all season long, plus local grains, meats, fish, baked goods, and specialty foods. Come enjoy the indoor marketplace with live music and a hot lunch. The market accepts SNAP and offers $2 Fresh Connect coupons. That's the Kingston Farmers Market inside the old Dutch church on Wall Street in Uptown Kingston every other Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Find out more about our schedule, events, and programs at kingstonfarmersmarket.org or on Facebook and Instagram.
Hi, I'm Kevin Godby. Join me Monday nights at 9 for Kingston Happenings. I'll help you stay informed about upcoming events, new businesses, initiatives from local nonprofits, and much more. I'll be chatting with movers, shakers, doers, and dreamers, the interesting people and personalities that are making things happen in our community, always with great music from local musicians. Kingston Happenings is the radio extension of my website that tells you about everything that's going on in the Kingston area, kingstonhappenings.org. Kingston Happenings, Monday nights at 9 p.m. here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 107.9, and anytime on radiokingston.org.
Welcome back to Nature Nuggets. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and we're having a wonderful conversation this morning with Omari Washington, Executive Director of Wild Earth, environmental education outfit in the Hudson Valley. And I want to say that if you have caught just a piece of this program and you want to hear the whole thing, or if you want to check out our archived episodes, they are all online, radiokingston.org, under the show Nature Nuggets. And we also have email. You can contact us directly if you have a suggestion for a guest that you think we should have on the air, or if you've got a burning question about the natural world, maybe something you've seen and don't understand, we can see if we can get to the bottom of it for you. That's naturenuggets@radiokingston.org. And finally, you can follow us on Instagram if you're over there. Our handle is @HVNatureNuggets on Instagram. So we put our shows up there and also just observations and curated content through the week. Awesome. Well, we only have a few minutes left, and I'm really enjoying, you're explaining the work that you do, Omari. And I'm wondering, you know, here we are, it's March. I think that we're starting to see some warmer days. We just got an hour added to the evening. I'm guessing that a lot of parents are starting to think about the summer and wondering, you know, what opportunities there might be for their kids. And so you've described a number of things already, but specifically, I'm wondering if you could speak to, I know spring break is coming up, you know, but if you're a parent in this community and wondering, you know, how you might get your kids involved in some of the things that you're doing, tell us about that.
Sure. Well, before summer arrives, we actually have our spring break camp, and that's a 3-day camp that will be happening in Rosendale area. We're confirming the location in the next few weeks. We've already confirmed the location. Sorry, it's Stone Mountain Farm, which is in like Rosendale-Tilson area. And that's for ages 5 to 13. It's April 15th through the 17th. And you can go to our website, wildearth.org, and click on the programs tab, and that will give you all the information, and you can sign up right there on the website. And if, you know, for the folks who are, you know, less tech savvy, you can also call our office, which is 845-256-9830. But, you know, Spring Break Camp, it's fully outdoors. It's a great introductory program because it's just 3 days. You know, they'll be learning a lot of different earth living skills, as I was naming before, building shelters and carving, knot tying, other crafts. And so Spring Break Camp's great. And then Summer Camp is, you know, our biggest program of the year, which it's July 7th through August 8th. But there are three sessions within that time span. The first two sessions are 2 week sessions, though they're for, and then there's a 1 week Earth Art Camp.
And are these overnight or are these day?
These are day camps. Okay. And there's a lot more information on our website, so I don't want to like go sure. into, you know, too much detail because there's a little bit of nuance. Yeah, you'll see on the website that there's a few 2 week sessions, this 1 week session and 1 4 week session. But this is for ages 4 to 18. Again, it's all outdoors. And you know, sometimes people don't realize that when they're signing up that like there is no indoor space for these programs. We set up tarps in case of inclement weather. If it gets really bad, we would, you know, cancel, but we typically are outside in all weather. We have bus service from New Paltz and Kingston this year for an additional fee. I think I mentioned earlier that we have this equitable pricing model, and the way that people can use a calculator on our website to determine the cost that they should pay based on their unique financial situation.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's so incredible. We live in such a rich area, you know, biodiversity wise and ecosystem wise, but the fact that we have organizations like yours that are offering that opportunity for kids of all ages to go and have direct experiences, you know, in the natural world. I just can't think of anything more important, really. for just pure sanity and well-being and, you know, personal development, leadership development. So thank you for the work you do.
And we also have programs for adults too.
Right.
One that's coming up in May, on the 24th and 25th of May, is buckskin sewing. So we use like a, you know, buckskin hide, and it's led by Neil Beauvaird, who is just an incredible tracker, and he really teaches reverence for you know, the deer, and so that's a really fun class for adults that's coming up.
Oh, that's like a day experience.
It'll be a 2 days, so May 24th. And 25th.
And it's like tanning? Or
He does do that in a different class that we teach, but okay. They'll just use the buckskin, I think, and create like a pouch or some other thing. Yeah.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Omari. I really appreciate highlighting the work of Wild Earth, and I hope folks will check out the organization and all the opportunities there are for kids. And with our just last few seconds here that we have on air, I want to highlight again all the opportunities that are coming up. There are so many, you know, organizations, including the John Burroughs Natural History Society, that are offering free guided nature walks. And so this coming weekend, there's vernal equinox walks to go look for American woodcocks. There's early signs of spring nature walks next Saturday. There's Tivoli Bay's birding. Go to jbnhs.org to check those out. And once again, I'll just say thank you so much, Omari, and for coming on the air and for all the work you do.
Thank you.
give myself to you.